Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest chapter, the latest great adventure on Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you this fine day?
I'm swinging away here, Michael. It's another fine day indeed.
You're not swinging from the chandeliers, Miss Jones. You know, it's a family show.
I've got any chandeliers. What do you want about?
Oh, right. Okay. Or jumping off the wardrobe, whatever it is. Now then, yes, absolutely.
The mind boggles.
Yes, it certainly does. What I was going to say is that only yesterday I ventured out and found an English hostelry, found a table outside, very nice, had some pints of beer and some fish goujons with chips and things. Very, very nice. But it wasn't off blinking cold, I tell you. There's a wind blowing, it's very cold. It makes it very unpleasant to go to the pub sitting outside if you're not in the sun and it's windy. And for the life of me, I can't understand the difference now between people sitting outside at tables which are 4 feet apart and people sitting inside the tables 4 feet apart. It's just, to my mind, blinking ridiculous. And they should lift the ban on inside drinking immediately.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with you. I went to the pub myself, actually. Trotted along to the Princess of Wales on Blackheath to sneak in. Hadn't actually booked, but thought we'd take a chance.
Yes.
And just strolled in and said, look, you know, we haven't booked. Have you got a table? Yes, we have.
Yeah.
And sat outside. They've got all those tall gas heaters that they liked when it gets a bit chilly, you know.
Yes.
And there were loads of those around and there was an awning and everything else. Yeah. But it was still so cold.
Yeah, I know.
And it's very hard to enjoy food, which is getting cold so quickly because you're outside.
That's right. I totally agree. And honestly, I just don't get it. You've got to wait now till May the 17th for the pubs to open inside. And I think it's June 21 for all restrictions to be lifted. And every time you turn on the telly now, you've got a debate between a scientist and you know, somebody who runs a pub company saying open the pubs. I don't get it. But I've been campaigning for so long now, I'm sounding like a broken record. I tell you what, I did pick up on the way back from the pub, beautiful bunch of yellow roses, which I put out on a Twitter picture yesterday. I have to say, they're stunning. I don't think I've ever seen yellow roses before. They're lovely.
My father was very fond of yellow roses, had a yellow rose tree just outside the French windows at their house. And he used to sit in his armchair and study that rose tree. He knew it, every single millimetre of that rose tree and how it would behave. And at his funeral, we had many wreaths of yellow roses. And in fact, on his anniversary, we always take my mother yellow roses. Yeah.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing. What a coincidence. It's like it's like maybe your father was sending me a message about the podcast or something when I saw these roses.
Yeah. I'm sure he is. He's keeping his eye on you.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now then, isn't this war of attrition in Downing Street becoming ridiculous? I mean, the latest one this morning, if this is proven, I think Boris is in a bit of trouble. Boris said, let the bodies pile high in their thousands. I mean, good God, I don't know. That could have been a throwaway statement, couldn't it, when they're arguing between another lockdown or damaging the economy. And, you know, I suppose you can hear him saying it, really, can't you? Although he denies it.
It was the first thought that went through my mind. I can absolutely hear him saying that.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing he says.
Yeah.
It is an appalling thing when you unpick it and analyse the statement and its implications. But, I mean, Boris has always shot from the lip, hasn't he?
Yes.
I think with Cummings, we're waiting for the book deal, aren't we? I mean, he's snuck out onto his blog again, having been silent for such a long time. And now the bombshell, the devastation, it's not going to stop at a blog. I think he's done a massive book deal with some publisher.
Yeah, you could well be right. The thing is, I think he is almost clinically mad, Dominic Cummings. You know what I mean? You see that mad stare in his eyes and the way he's reacted so violently to, to counter claims from Downing Street. It's just crazy the way it's going on. Everybody now is saying that Boris is a terrible strategist because he shouldn't have inflamed the situation by publicly naming Dominic Cummings as the source of the leaks about the row over decorating the flat and the row over Dyson, you know, and giving him tax breaks to bring ventilator machines into the country. But Boris, in his defence, says, I did it to clear my girlfriend's name. So on the one hand, people are always calling Boris the old misogynist. On the second one, he's put his career on the line to protect Carrie. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we have to dilute everything that's said at the moment, yeah, don't we?
But sure.
I think Cummings had been used as a whipping post for all this time. And he was to blame for this and that and the other. And everybody has their breaking point. And he's obviously sat there and he's gone, right, enough already. You know, really, there are two sides to this story. In fact, there are three: his, hers, and the truth. Yeah. And it's time that I put my side of the story out there because I'm sick and tired of being to blame for everything. And and also being ridiculed for his trips to Barnard Castle and all the rest of it. He's having his say now. This could go anywhere. There's almost a film in this, I feel.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The only thing I would say is that I don't know why everybody's getting so excited about it, because it's 3.5 years to the next election. This will all be well forgotten by then. It's all very well, you know, people going around mouthing sleaze, sleaze, sleaze. But all politicians are immersed in sleaze. That's the game of politics. I think it'll all blow over, to be honest, in a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
Well, he's appearing before a parliamentary inquiry
on
the 26th of May to answer questions about, he has said, absolutely any issue. Anything could happen yet, and we know how the media will feel about this. They'll just lap it up,
and
keep stoking the fires, I think.
This
isn't going away for a while.
No, I don't think it will, but, you know, it can only drift into oblivion eventually. So much time to the next election. I can't see Boris standing down, apart from anything else. He needs the job for the money. Talking about people looking after their partners in life, I see that old Johnny Lydon is now full-time carer to his wife, who's got Alzheimer's. That's quite a diversion for a man who was once the ultimate bad boy of rock and roll, isn't it?
I think the Sex Pistols, that was all a stance, wasn't it? That was Malcolm McLaren put together a boy band and wanted them to be as bad and as vicious and as vile as they could possibly be.
Yes.
So that was all a creation. It's a long time ago. John Lydon has had a long career since then. And he happened to have a partner who's significantly older than him.
Yeah.
And so her health issues were always going to catch up with her before his. And to his great credit, he's looked after his partner for a long time now. I think she's had Alzheimer's for years.
Yeah.
But I don't know why they're talking about it again now.
Yeah, well, I think he might have a book out or something, but anyway, it was all over the Sunday Times last weekend. And talking about rock stars and health, Rolling Stone Ronnie Wood has revealed he secretly battled cancer for a second time during lockdown. Guitar legend, 73, diagnosed with rare and aggressive small cell cancer. I feel very sorry for Ronnie for having gone through that, but many would say it's a wonder he's still alive, wouldn't they?
Well, I don't know. Has he lived that bad a life? I'm not sure he's been that reckless, Ronnie Wood, has he?
Well, I think he's got quite a history. I mean, I remember the famous quote that one time when he was heavily into cocaine, he looked down and he could look through the cartilage of his nose and see his feet, you know, because he put so much cocaine up his nose, it sort of eroded most of it.
I think cocaine tends to bring on heart attacks rather than cancer. I'm not sure that it's carcinogenic.
Yeah.
But, I mean, those were the days when the Rolling Stones were going around saying they thought cocaine was good for you. They didn't know, did they, back then in
really?
The 70s? No, I don't think they knew. I'm not excusing them, of course, illegal Class A drugs and whatever else. But, no, I feel very sorry for Ronnie. He's got very young children. He's got twins with his wife, Sally, and it would be a dreadful shame if anything happened to him.
Yeah, it would. It would. No, I totally agree. It'd be dreadful. I keep thinking, what would I do if suddenly I heard Mick Jagger had died? And, you know, God forbid, obviously. Or and more even, God forbid, Sir Paul McCartney. I mean, it would take people out of our lives that have literally been in our lives, all our lives, if you see what I mean. I mean,
well,
I know that
people's. Yeah, that's what they said when Prince Philip died. He'd been around all our lives. But
absolutely.
In a way, because you never meet these people, do you? You don't spend time with these people. They're not part of your inner circle. And they are signposts along the way of your life. So it is very difficult when those signposts fall down. You sort of lose your way a bit. But, I mean, that kind of thing has always happened. The Queen is going to die. McCartney, Mick Jagger, all these people are going to die. So are we. So the fabric of our lives is going to disintegrate. We have to just suck it up, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And then it's all forgotten so quickly. You know what I mean? It happens as a terrible period of grief and all that, and bang, then you have to move on. Just like when Lord Nelson died. I mean, you know, the country was in mourning for 2 years after Lord Nelson died, but eventually you have to move on and you just become a figure in history. Now, what about this one, Miss Jones? Well, we all shang-a-lang as we go with the gang. Do it, do up, be do we do, eh? That, sadly, I'm afraid, is indicative of somebody else who's died.
Yeah, Les McKeown, it's very sad, that story. And of course, it gave the media the opportunity to drag up all the scandal about his secret gay life and his long-suffering wife, Pico, putting up with it for 30-odd years. Yeah. He claimed he was raped when he was 19 by another man, and that this gave him a secret taste for gay sex. Oh, and he'd go off meeting strangers. His wife had no idea all this was going on until he exposed it. This was a bit cowardly, I thought, in a TV documentary. So she knew nothing about it until he talked about it on television. And at that point, he was downing two bottles of bourbon a day. He was going off to the pub at 9 a.m, going home for a sleep, going back to the pub. Quite often, the publican had to call an ambulance to get him out of the place.
Where was this? And was this in America or here?
No, this was all here. And he led her an absolute dog's life, and she stuck by him. Gosh. And I think it's very important to see both sides of the story there.
Yeah.
You know, we're all very sad because another one of our kind of stalwart heroes has bitten the dust and left this mortal coil. But what about that poor woman, and what about their son?
Yes,
What's the lasting impact on their child from all that?
I totally agree. The rollers came to prominence when I was a trainee journalist. I was at the training centre, Thompson Regional Newspaper Training Centre in Newcastle, and the three of us living in a little flat there. And I remember the telly going on, Top of the Pops, and then Les McKeown, bye bye baby, baby goodbye, and they completely took over the world. When I went back to Newcastle 2 years later to work on the Evening Chronicle, I went with the Pop Reviewer to a Bay City Rollers concert in Newcastle. And, you know, it was Beatlemania times 100, the amount of girls screaming, little girls screaming, and all that kind of stuff, all the tartan and all that, you know. And then he wrote a review in the evening paper the next day to say he thought they were a load of rubbish. And then, like, hundreds of young girls started coming to the office and wanted to attack him, you know, tried to break in and we're going to kill you, we love the Rollers and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was mayhem, but they certainly made their presence felt, didn't they?
They did. And of course, their tartan teenage army, try saying that without your teeth in, it was a major force, wasn't it? But it was all a lie because they were sex symbols to young nubile teenagers and they were living a lie. And do you know who it reminded me of? It was George Michael. George Michael was sneaking off up to Hampstead Heath to have sex with strange men. Yeah. Many of those men were married with families and lives that they didn't want to sacrifice. So George felt that this was the safest kind of man to have secret sex with, somebody who had as much to lose as he did. So I think there's a bit of that going on here, or there was as well. Yeah. And it's terribly sad when your army of young fans are duped like that, because they're eventually going to find out. And then they're going to feel very bitter about how they spent their teenage years following and being devoted to somebody who wasn't actually really there for them.
Yeah, well, I suppose you'll grow up and grow out of that, really, don't you? The average age of their fans is about 15, so I suppose by the time they're 18, they're probably over it, but and didn't find out about, you know, the secrets till many years later. You said that Les McKeown spent all day in the pub and then went home for it and then went back. I mean, that sounds to a man of great social habits like me, like the ideal life, you know. Oh, yeah, I've made all my money now and I'm okay and I sit in the pub all day, except that I can't think of a sadder existence. And it immediately reminds me of George Best's last years, okay? And what George used to do is, he used to get up at 9 o'clock in the morning and he'd go to his local pub in Chelsea. He used to live in Chelsea, had a little place there, but he also lived down in Surrey, in Stockbroker Belt, where I live, with the the girl he married, Alex somebody. But he'd get up in Chelsea, go to the pub. 9 o'clock, he'd, you know, the landlord would hear this knock on the window of the door, and it was George. He'd let him in. Pub didn't open to anybody else till 11:30. So by the time the pub opened at 11:30, George was already on his second or third bottle of wine, and he would stay there till 9 o'clock at night. And he'd sit on the same stool at the same end of the bar, and people knew he was there and left him alone. And, you know, that's a very sad existence, isn't it?
It is, and it smacks of trying to drink away memories, especially if you've had bad things happen to you in your life. And obviously Les McKeown did.
Yeah.
But sitting there trying to drink away your life and to not face up to your problems and come to terms with yourself.
Yes.
No, that is an incredibly sad way to live.
Yes, no, I totally agree. And actually, because you're never sober, you're never able to reflect on how sad it is, if you see what I mean. When you get up at 9 o'clock the following morning, you just need your first drink to get you back into that sort of feeling of not caring, you know what I mean, and that sort of thing. I think I've told you this story before. I was in the Virgin Islands once and found this remote little bar on the edge of a cliff, you know, made of bamboo and that sort of stuff. I'm a typical Caribbean bar. And I sort of, you know, went in and I said hello, I had a drink, I had a beer or something. There was a bloke sitting on the at the end of the bar around the corner, so to speak, and I just engaged in conversation with him. And it turned out his was exactly the same life story. He'd kind of given up on life. He'd sold up everything he had in Britain. He'd moved to the Virgin Islands, bought a very cheap sort of little shack, and then was spending the rest of the money he had deliberately drinking himself to death in this bar all day in the most gorgeous sort of location, you know, on the edge of a cliff overlooking a beach, beautiful weather. And he just decided that's how he wanted to go out.
Yeah, it's a shameful waste, isn't it, really?
Well, he had nothing else to do in life. That's what he said. He said, nothing else to do now, so why not? I enjoy a drink and I enjoy the weather.
Yeah, but then you're going to hit the wall. You're going to get health issues.
Yeah,
he's going to expect treatment in a hospital at some point, and that's going to be a very painful, lonely death.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. What you always hope in that is that you just suddenly drop dead, you know what I mean? And then it's all sorted. But anyway, there we are. Now, Miss Jones, without embarrassing you, I think it's fair to say that you were renowned as the beauty of Fleet Street in your working day.
Oh, yes. I'm not sure about that.
Oh, yes. No, you were. You were stunningly attractive, and every man fell at your feet if you wanted them to, which, of course, you didn't, because you're an independent and highly talented journalist. But I read a piece last week which really touched me, and it was it's about a woman called Shona Sibari. And she's nobody in particular, except that she was born ugly. It wasn't her fault. She had very crooked teeth and she had a slight deformity around her eye and a birthmark on her face. And she says, we talk about sexism, but what about lookism? When did you see a Bond girl with a face like mine? And she's telling her story of how difficult her life has been because she's not just sort of plain. She's actually ugly. And that must be a terrible, terrible thing for a young lady to grow up with.
Well, she says she cracks mirrors. I had a look at some pictures of this lady, and she's really not that bad looking, you know.
Well, she's had a lot of work done on her face during her life, you see, but she's talking about her teenage years, her adolescent years.
Her kids are absolutely gorgeous.
Yes,
so we don't know what her husband looks like. But she was agreeing with Olivia Colman that being plain can actually be an advantage because she has great strength of character, and her husband married her for her personality rather than her looks, which we know lasts longer than looks. So, you know, who's the loser? I always thought this about the very pretty girls at school, for example. They tended not to have had careers because they got snapped up very quickly by the best looking blokes.
Yeah.
They got married very young. They had children very young.
Right.
And then they got discarded in their early 40s when the husband was looking for another trophy wife.
Yeah.
So they tended to end up having quite sad lives.
Yes.
This is the girls I knew at school anyway.
Yes.
Those of us who weren't quite so conventionally good looking had to find other things to get us through our lives. And and probably had more success ultimately, I would say.
Yeah.
It's an interesting point. I feel she's done herself down a bit here, but what's the message she's giving to her children who are, as I've just said, very good looking kids?
Yeah.
I suppose she's telling them, don't rely on your reflection, but find other things within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
to get through life on. And that's a pretty good message, isn't it?
Yeah, but being bullied at school because of your looks and all that. I mean, children can be terribly cruel, can't they? And I remember once we were at a disco when I was about 17 or 18. And it was like a converted boathouse on the banks of the River Dee in Chester, where, you know, I was brought up and we're at school. And there was one poor girl hiding in the corner because she was about 6'5" and she was still only about 17, you know what I mean? 16 or 17. And everybody else was out on the dance floor. And my heart melted for this poor girl. And I thought, you know, she won't come up and get on the dance floor because she's so embarrassed. She's a freak. She's so tall. So I went over and I dragged her off the stool and I got her onto the dance floor. And you can't believe how grateful she was, you know, to have been involved in it all. And as soon as I started dancing, other people danced with her, you know. But I did feel sorry for her. And I got talking to her and she said, it is a terrible problem. You know, I walk with my shoulders hunched. You know, I try to stoop. I don't like people to see how tall I am. I can't wear hats and I have to wear flat shoes. And it blighted her poor life.
I've got a friend who's extremely tall and she always said she's married with a child and incredibly successful in her career. You would know who she is. Yeah. And she said that she thought she'd never get married because she was so tall and she stood out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
And she did. She met the right guy. She married, had a lovely child, has had an amazing career. So I think it's just a question of overcoming. Back in those days, we didn't have all the counselling and everything they have nowadays.
Yeah.
And you can get a lot of help with such things today. Yeah. I think teenagers and young people are infinitely more better off than we were, I suppose, because there are lots of resources to help people. In those days, you did just have to hunch your shoulders or, you know, hide under your fringe or whatever else and make your way as best you could.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Of course, you never had that problem, Miss Jones. And happily, I have to say, I didn't either. I was quite a catch, actually, in my adolescent teenage years. And that will come as no surprise to you, Miss Jones, you know?
No, not at all. You were very sought after on Fleet Street, as I recall, and had quite a career with the ladies.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say so, Miss Jones, but I couldn't possibly comment, could I? Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Miss Jones, I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to give me a very straight answer. Have you ever fancied a quickie with a brickie?
Absolutely not. Yeah. How very dare you?
Yes.
This is an appalling thing to say.
Well, I ask you that out of research, right? Because I have a report here. Nearly half of Britain's tradesmen have been propositioned on the job. Builders, plumbers, bricklayers and electricians have been asked to strip off, have threesomes and even repair sex toys at raunchy customers' homes. I mean, goodness gracious me, what world do these people live in? That's never happened to me.
Well, you didn't even put the plunger down.
Oh, come on, Miss Jones, for goodness sake. What about the family show theory?
Family show. Yeah. Well, you're talking about getting more bang for your buck. That's what this is all about, isn't it, really?
Your buck, goodness gracious.
Well, I think I had a dishwasher repairman came round to my house a few years ago.
Oh, yes. Oh, hey, folks, cup your ears. This sounds saucy. Yes, please, go on.
He was on his knees fiddling around with my dishwasher.
Knees? Yeah. Yeah.
And he started telling me about this woman who answered the front door to him. I'm not joking. He said this completely stark naked, which was an invitation, I suppose, to him. And I was really taken aback. My blood ran cold. You know that feeling where it feels as though your blood's actually stopped circulating in your body?
Yes.
I froze and I thought, okay, what have we got here? Is this guy propositioning me? Is he suggesting something? Do I need to run a mile? Shall I call the police? What shall I do?
Yeah.
And I just sort of laughed it off. And I said, well, look, I'll be in my office if you need me. Give me a shout. And fled from my own kitchen thinking, how do I handle this? I'm in my house with a complete stranger, a man, and anything could happen here. I felt very threatened by it.
Yeah,
and so I can't really understand why these guys could be anybody. They could be axe murderers.
I totally agree. How did that resolve itself and how did you reflect on it afterwards? Do you think he was just trying to be sort of chatty or do you think he had more sinister motives?
I think he was testing me to see whether I would be up for it.
Yeah,
and I've thought about it a lot over the years. It quite often crops up in my memory.
Really? So still with you all these years
to this
later.
Day. Yeah, yeah, it does. And it's one of those things because it had no resolution. I just, off I went to my office. I didn't really work. I just sat there thinking, God, what do I do now? You know, I can hardly leave the house because it's my house and he's here in my home. Oh. What do I do? He hasn't actually done anything, so I can't accuse him. I couldn't really ask him to leave because he was there doing the job. I suppose I could have reported it now. I would probably do this, report it to the company who sent him.
Yes, but it's very sort of borderline, isn't it? You know, they might say, well, he was only being chatty, you know, he was only telling you about an experience. He wasn't propositioning you.
Exactly. They know where you live.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you cause problems for these people, there are likely to be repercussions. Yeah. It's very difficult. I think we walk a tightrope as women, whatever age we are, because we know that older ladies get raped, get sexually assaulted, get attacked.
Yeah.
So I think there isn't an age limit on it. We're not suddenly safe because we're middle-aged or whatever. Yeah.
No,
this kind of thing can happen to us throughout our lives.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you read about these surveys all the time. And you remember in the 70s, a load of films were made about, was it robbing somebody? And he was supposed to be a sex maniac, you know, driving instructor. And then he had another job as a window cleaner. And all the time he was getting the come on from women. You know, I can't remember, was it Robin Newell or somebody? But they were saucy films, probably before your time. But it perpetuated this idea of the frustrated housewife, you know. Now, I did a paper round for years and years and years. I was too young then, obviously, to be propositioned by women. But in between leaving school and getting into journalism, I drove a Corona pop wagon, okay?
Now there's a euphemism. I drove a Corona pop wagon.
No, I did. Honestly,
the secret life of Michael Parry.
That's right. Do you remember the Corona pop wagons?
Yes, I do. We had Corona.
Yeah,
the guy used to come around once a week and deliver the stuff.
That's right. Yeah, big yellow lorry. Open sides on the back, 60 crates of dandelion and burdock, lemonade, limeade. Apple cider. Oh, I loved it. Honestly, it was a great job. And I used to go roaring off, you know, into Cheshire, to this town, that town, and all that. And I was very, very good at it because I worked very hard. I was always out more hours than anybody else, and I went faster than everybody else. And I ran up and down the pathways to make sure I could get to as many houses as possible. And I, you know, made record amounts of sales bonuses and all that kind of stuff. But And I was quite a dashing young chap in those days. I was 19 years of age and all that. And I had my smart Corona man yellow overall on, you know, and which you can imagine. But I went to thousands of houses and never once, because I was, you know, keeping half an eye open just in case, never once did I get the come on from, you know, a frustrated housewife.
Well, maybe you were supposed to give her the come on. I don't know how it works. But, I mean, there used to be a thing when I was a child. People used to joke about, oh, Mrs. Thing up the road at number 17. She invites the milkman in.
Yeah.
And that's a sort of euphemism for somebody who is sort of up for it, I suppose.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Well, Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West. Oh, yeah. Ernie, Ernie. And he drove the fastest milk cart in the West. And one line in that says, he got his cocoa at 23 three times every week, you know, and that was a sort of euphemism, wasn't it? You know,
that was Benny Hill, wasn't it? Yeah.
Oh, what did I say?
No, it was Benny Hill who made the song.
Benny Hill, that's right. Yeah, who made the song. Yeah. Ernie the Milkman, yeah.
And, but, you know, it doesn't go away because I was talking to my mum yesterday.
Yes.
My mum's 86.
Yes.
And she was all in a fluster when I got round there, and there was a vase of bright orange roses. I'd never seen roses quite as orange as these. I said, oh, yeah, where did those come from? She said, they came from the guy next door. So she said he came down the drive with this. He had his hand behind his back.
Right.
And then when I opened the door, he sort of flourished these things at me and said, oh, please have these. And thank you very much for letting me park my car on your drive last week.
Right.
So I said, why did you let him park his car on your drive?
Yeah.
Oh, because he had visitors and they didn't have enough room and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And she said, it's a bit odd, isn't it? A guy comes down your drive and suddenly flourishes these flowers. She said, what if the neighbours are looking out the window and thinking, why is he taking her flowers and his wife is indoors?
Yeah.
And my mum was quite upset about it.
Yeah, I don't
think that generation, it's all about how it looks to other people, isn't it?
Yes.
I think we don't care as much, do we?
No.
What people think? But that generation certainly cares what people think.
I think that's a bit overbearing, though, honestly, to be honest. I don't know what the guy was up to, but it seems to me like a fairly pointless gesture. I totally agree with you. But there we are. What do you think of Gordon Ramsay, then?
I actually like Gordon Ramsay. He's one of those guys. There's a series on at the moment where he's going off around the
Italy. Fred, all these,
oh my God. And there, Gino is there brandishing his bits on nudist beaches and all the rest of it. Yeah. And they're getting up to all sorts in their van as they career about the place. It's a very vulgar show.
Yes.
I don't think we really need stuff like this on television.
Yes.
But I think on the other hand, I did a job with him once for the Mail on Sunday. We had to go around these very expensive shishi flats around London in various locations.
Right.
And Gordon's job was to assess the kitchens because these flats were like 2 million quid each. This is some years ago.
Yes.
So it tells you how lavish these flats were. Mm. And we were in a Bentley, very glamorous, with a driver and going in and assessing these flats. And he had to say what was wrong with the kitchens. It was a great idea, good feature.
Yeah.
And then he drew up a blueprint, which I've still got somewhere, of how the ideal kitchen should be constructed.
Yeah.
And actually, he was very personable, very down to earth. We had a good laugh doing the job. And I've always rather liked him, but I can see why people don't.
Well, he gets on my nerves a bit for the all the swearing bit and all that. It's like, you know, he has to now because it's expected of him. And it started when he did that, show when he was in the restaurant and the camera followed him through the night and he was effing this and effing that and really shouting at his commie chefs and sacking them on the spot. And I thought it was all an act, and I still think a lot of it's an act. And he's now, the reason I brought him up is because he's got a new show, and believe it or not, it's called FFS. And it's supposed to stand for Future Food Stars. But as we all know, FFS, of course, is an expression used on social media, and it means for sake, doesn't it? And people use it to try and sort of, you know, show how down to earth they are about things or something.
It's supposed to be cool, isn't it? It's not cool, really.
Yeah.
My kids, my two younger kids, are very friendly with his son, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
He's actually a twin. My daughter was in a production of Grease with Jack Ramsay, who was a pretty nifty little actor, actually, but he's in the army now.
Yes. Oh, in the army. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So imagine that. He also went to Exeter University when my youngest was there. And so I think he wasn't quite sure what he wanted to do with his life. And now he's ended up in the army, which does seem a strange kind of turn of events. But imagine you're in a very upright sort of regimented environment and your dad is swearing all over television.
Yeah, exactly. Funny. Oh, I admire anybody joins up for the armed forces. I mean, that's a real commitment to your country. And by the way, I can't criticise Gordon Ramsay for the fact that he's made a huge success of his life. This story that brought me this news about FFS says that he's worth £190 million. And, any guy who's done that well has my total admiration. Also, he's a friend of the Beckhams. I mean, that is quite something in life, isn't it? To say, oh, yeah, I was over in LA last week. We had lunch with David and Victoria. I mean, you know, he's made a huge success of it. I just think that he's the old swearing thing, which is his badge, is now worn out. But anyway, what do I know about it? I'm not hugely successful as he is.
He came at a big price, by the way.
Because
they fell out with his wife's family, didn't they?
He was in
business.
His father-in-law.
Yeah. And they've all fallen out. And so all those lovely children that they've got, the grandparents never see them. So there's always a downside, I think. You know, it's very easy to sit there going, it's all right for them.
Yeah.
They've got one of the most wonderful houses in Wandsworth. He's rolling in cash. He can go to LA whenever he wants and hang out with the Beckhams.
Mm. Yeah.
If you haven't got your fundamental family relationships, you've lost quite a lot, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I suppose you're right. Talking about the army, by the way, just apropos nothing. My sister lives down in Bournemouth and there's another family in the street a few doors along. And they've got a young lad who grew up with my nephew, you know, and his only ambition in life was to join the Royal Marines. He wanted to be an officer in the Royal Marines. Do you know, he tried five times and five times he went through the officer training school for the Royal Marines and still never made it by a small percentage point each time. He just wasn't up to it. And that actually really comforted me. And I thought the standards must be very, very high because this lad was immaculately fit. You know what I mean? You know, he was good looking, short hair, carried himself well, but he couldn't get into the officers' ranks in the Royal Marines. And that, you know, that quite comforted me.
I think there is these days a tremendous psychological aspect to those things.
Yeah.
And they test them not only physically and in terms of their academic ability, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think they also are looking for that chink in the armor. Is this somebody who could stand up to the stresses and strains of combat?
Yes.
You know, is this somebody who's psychologically a little bit on the weak side?
Yeah.
I think that plays a huge part these days.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Psychological warfare, I mean, I know there isn't psychological warfare, but you're absolutely right. I think the accent on mental health throughout our society now is huge. And 30 years ago, nobody even mentioned mental health. They just told you to take an aspirin and go and lie down or whatever, you know. But anyway, there we are. What do you think of the latest pictures we've seen in the last 72 hours of little Prince Louis taken by his mother, Kate? I thought they were fantastic pictures.
He's very cute, isn't he? He's the image of his maternal grandfather, Michael Middleton, Kate's dad.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Very sweet little boy. And she does take a good picture. You know, people like to criticise, oh, why are they using family snaps? Why don't they use a professional? But,
yeah.
Of course, a mother who's got any sort of aptitude for using a camera is always going to get a much nicer picture than a strange photographer,
yeah.
Because that little boy is responding to his mummy behind the lens.
Yes, that's right. He is, isn't he? And she's saying, oh, come on, Louis, give me a smile or something.
Exactly.
Much more likely to smile than well, if it's a photographer. Talking about successful people, by the way, we just talked about, what's his name? The chef.
Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah. sorry, yeah. Memory.
FFS, Michael.
Yeah, that's right, FFS. 3 minutes, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I noticed that old Ken Barlow, that's William Roach, is 89 this week. And I know you're not a huge television fan, but you will have seen Coronation Street maybe a couple of times over the years. And it's incredible. This guy's been in Coronation Street for 60 years, over 60 years, and he's still going strong. And he's a druid and he puts on the white robes, you know, on the solstice day and goes off to Stonehenge and all that. And he says his longevity is all about the fact that he believes in the power of life being given to him through the air that he breathes and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Well, he's even said that he wants to stay on Coronation Street until he's 100.
Yes.
And be the first centenarian working on a soap, which, yes, is quite an ambition, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I heard him on the radio. I was driving somewhere last year sometime, and
yeah,
and he came on to do an interview about his latest book. He's published a few about how to live a long, healthy life is basically the message.
Yeah.
He's very compelling on the radio. He speaks very eloquently. And he was saying that, I think after about 20 years on Coronation Street, he started to feel very dissatisfied, thinking, is this all my life is about? Confined to one soap opera, I've never been able to stretch my wings and to find out whether I would have been a good character actor, whether I could have done feature films, all of that kind of stuff. But then he realized that he should be grateful for what he had,
yeah,
because he's made something unique that is completely his.
Yes.
He's had quite a tragic life. He lost his 18-month-old daughter back in the 80s. She died just in her sleep. And then another daughter of his died from liver failure when she was 50. His second wife died when she was only 58. So he's had quite a lot to go through. And I think he's arrived at this place of tranquility and philosophy,
yeah,
in his life after having gone through lots of challenges.
Yeah.
And I think he's a very worthwhile man. I think we should keep listening to him.
Well, no,
do you remember when he sued the Sun, didn't he, way back?
It was unbelievable. And do you know why he sued them? Because they described him as boring.
That's right, yeah. And I think that didn't they offer to settle out of court or something?
I think he lost a lot of money.
He did lose. Yeah, he had to pay costs, six figures. And then he was declared bankrupt in 1999.
Right. That's right. All because somebody described him as boring. I mean, crikey, you know, when you think about it, so anybody who read that, it's the fatal mistake, isn't it? Anybody who read that and saw a reference to William Roach being boring, it would have registered with them for one nanosecond in their head, and then they'd forgotten about it forevermore, and they'd never remember about it again. But to go to court and try and fight a case because you've been described as being boring not only multiplies it a million times in people's minds, but it's the most ridiculous premise on which to try and prove a point, isn't it?
Well, I remember Elton John saying that when he was going to sue the Sun,
yeah,
and Mick Jagger phoned him up and said, don't bother, just let it go. You know, let them write what they like. It'll be forgotten in a couple of days. True. You really can't fight these things because they will make it worse for you.
Yeah.
But Elton was determined to get the Sun.
Yeah, he was.
And he did, because they got the right story and the right guy and all the right detail, but they got the wrong date. It was out by one day.
Absolutely.
So he was able to win his fight.
Yeah. I mean, there were some amazing stories surrounding Elton John. There was that one. Another one was, get this, they wrote a story saying that Elton John had the vocal cords on the voice boxes removed from the dogs in the grounds of his house in Windsor because it was keeping him awake at night. I mean, an utterly preposterous story. If they'd have checked with the vet, they'd have found that that can't possibly happen, you know. But just to check this out, the reporter whose patch it covered, because he didn't write the story, somebody else wrote the story, and he thought, that can't be right. So he went along to Elton John's house, and he stood outside, and then he went to a phone box, rang the office, and said, look, you're going to have to pull that story. And they said, why? He said, I'm standing outside Elton John's house. I can hear the dogs barking inside. But they didn't pull the story. It was the sheer arrogance of Fleet Street in those days.
I mean, I'm sure that no vet would perform that operation anyway. That's animal abuse, isn't it?
Exactly. But it sounds like a great story, doesn't it, if people are gullible enough to actually believe it. Now, Ms. Jones, apart from all your other talents and characteristics in life, you are somewhat of a sort of chef or a cook or, you know, you certainly know your way around the kitchen. So what do you think about the millennials helping to create a boom in corned beef?
Well, this I couldn't quite believe. I think it's the most disgusting substance, corned beef.
Yeah.
But I found out that it was the most searched for recipe, corned beef hash, on the Prince's website. You know, Prince, who Prince's, they can corned beef, don't they? And then I thought, I don't actually know what corned beef really is, apart from the fact that it's beef. So I looked it up, and it's made by salt curing beef brisket, which is a very tough cut of meat, and it's made edible by soaking it in brine, which is rather a horrible thing. So it's essentially pickled beef, which makes it more sliceable. And the Irish eat it with cabbage, don't they? And the Jewish people eat it in sandwiches, hot salt beef, they call it.
Yeah.
It's very cheap and it's very available. And I think this was just part of people's drive to try and live more economically during the lockdown period, when people were looking for nostalgic things and for comfort food and for stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't quite get this story. It says young adults are rebelling against their woke vegan reputation and tucking into the canned meat instead. Sales surged by £9.8 million to nearly £100 million over the past year. And that was aided by big growth among shoppers aged 28 to 44. So I can't quite understand the rebellion against veganism, because veganism is growing all the time. But I love corned beef. Now, you say it's disgusting and all that. The reason it is as it is, and you're absolutely right in what you've told our millions of listeners, is because it was great to take on board ships on long voyages, because the salt in the beef preserved the beef, you see what I mean? But it came out like corned beef, so to speak. But I absolutely love corned beef. I eat it all the ways you've illustrated. I love it on fluffy white bread with lots of butter and a corned beef sandwich. I love a corned beef hash. I will eat corned beef on a plate with tomatoes and beetroot. And I really love it. I know it's very, very cheap, and that, you know, somewhat sort of taints its nutritional value, but I say each to their own.
It's not very good for you, is it? Because it's salt cured. Well, and it's not very good for your heart.
No, but I'm a salt addict. I love salt. I have to.
Well, that's going to kill you. That is. You're going to have to address that, Mike.
Well, you say that, but the point is that I always like a packet of peanuts when I'm drinking beer, because there's a chemical reaction between alcohol and sodium in the salt, which gives you a satisfying feeling. And I can't drink beer without a packet of crisps, or peanuts. But I put salt on everything. I put so much salt on my chips that you can actually see the glistening salt like snowflakes on my chips. You know, I know it's bad for you, but I can't enjoy food without salt.
I bet you put salt on your boiled egg too, don't you?
I've never eaten an egg.
Never eaten an egg?
I've never eaten an egg, Miss Jones. I think I've told you this before. I've never eaten an egg in my life. My mum tried to feed me eggs when I was a little kid, or egg sandwich, or just a poached egg or something like that. And I was always ill. And I've been ill ever since. I can't stand the rubbery rubbery constitution of an egg. And although I love to see a plate of bacon and eggs, I think they look so nice, a fried egg and bacon. I love bacon, but I just can't touch egg. I can't.
It's an interesting thing about an egg. I've sometimes thought, because I do think too much sometimes. Yes. And when you think about what an egg is, it's a hen's menstruation, isn't it?
Oh, don't go there, honestly. I've thought about that all my time. And also, you read these daft stories of people bringing eggs home from the supermarket, and all of a sudden, one of them suddenly hatches. How could anybody eat a food that happens to?
Well, kids as well, they get these boxes of eggs and they hatch them at home just for an experiment.
Yeah.
You've seen quite a lot of pictures of people doing that.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it's no different from you eating a leg of lamb or a pork chop or whatever else.
Well, it doesn't come back to life, the leg of lamb, does it?
No, but you haven't cooked it yet. If the thing hatches, it hasn't yet been boiled. Did you not know that bit?
Yes, of course I do. But I mean, I don't wish to go there. Ms. Jones, we can't leave today's podcast without referring back again to the scandal of the slimy six football clubs who were trying to break away. And since I last spoke to you, I've seen a wonderful piece, two-page spread on the chairman of my football club, Mr. Bill Kenwright, speaking out for, you know, the clubs in the community, speaking out for the fans, speaking out for the hundreds of years of tradition of football. And I have to say, Mr. Kenwright's been a friend of mine for many years, but I felt really, really proud of the fact that he stepped forward and said, we would never have entered into an agreement like this under any circumstances. We owe it to our community and to our fans to rise above such things.
Good old Bill. You know, we love Bill. And yet again, he's stepped up and said and done the right thing. But as I said last time, the damage is done. The fans are wounded by this.
Yeah.
It's an affront to their fandom and to their loyalty to their club. And this is not going away for a long time, I feel.
Yeah, no,
people are going to be very cross about this for quite some time to come.
No, I think you're right. In that piece, I also read that Mr. Kenwright is putting on a production of Hamlet somewhere in London, and he's got some of the big new productions. So I may just acquire a couple of tickets and perhaps we can go to a first night or something like that. And
that would be fabulous. And I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and go and see Mr. Kenwright and have a chat. So there we go. Ms. Jones, thank you very much indeed. And thank you to our millions of listeners for having tuned in again. And all I can say is, May the 17th isn't that far away now. That's when the pubs open indoors. I say, open the pubs now.
We are counting down and I'll see you down there. In those days, you did just have to hunch your shoulders or, you know, hide under your fringe or whatever else and make your way as best you could.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Of course, you never had that problem, Miss Jones. And happily, I have to say, I didn't either. I was quite a catch, actually, in my adolescent teenage years. And that will come as no surprise to you, Miss Jones, you know?
No, not at all. You were very sought after on Fleet Street, as I recall, and had quite a career with the ladies.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say so, Miss Jones, but I couldn't possibly comment, could I? Have you ever fancied a quickie with a brickie?
Absolutely not. How very dare you?
Yes.
What an appalling thing to say.
Well, I ask you that out of research, right? Because I have a report here. Nearly half of Britain's tradesmen have been propositioned on the job. Builders, plumbers, bricklayers and electricians have been asked to strip off, have threesomes and even repair sex toys at raunchy customers' homes. I mean, goodness gracious me, what world do these people live in? That's never happened to me.
Well, you didn't even put the plunger down.
Oh, come on, Miss Jones, for goodness sake. What about the family show
theory? Family show. Yeah. Well, you're talking about getting more bang for your buck. That's what this is all about, isn't it, really?
Your buck, goodness gracious. I drove a Corona pop wagon, okay?
Now there's a euphemism. I drove a Corona pop wagon.
No, I did. Honestly.
The Secret Life of Michael Parry.
No,